Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Well, spring is just weeks away. We're getting mixed signals, though. Most of the winter has been unseasonably warm, but there have been some pockets of cold weather, even a few big snowstorms in the region. My snowblower, however, is sitting in the garage, right at the front of the garage, waiting to work. Has not worked yet. El Nino is really giving it to us this year. Joining us on the show to talk weather and to take your weather questions is our old buddy meteorologist Jason Goff of WNYT News Channel 13 in Albany. His forecasts have been broadcast all around and right here on this station for a long time. We welcome Jason Goff back to the show. You know, it's always fun to blame him about the weather, but I can't blame him about anything this winter. It's been tolerable. The number to call is 800-348-2551. I'll blame him anyway. 800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or tweet us at WAMCVoxPop. But again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff, welcome back.
Thank you, sir. Pockets of cold, they've been shallow pockets, man.
Well, we had a couple of really cold nights.
Oh, yeah. We had that one weekend a couple of weeks ago. I actually had a great time. I rode with the Albany Fire Department a few weeks ago, and those guys were out
fixing.
No, they were out. They had a couple of calls, and it was like wicked cold. But you know, it's obviously some winters have been a heck of a lot worse than others. With the cold this year, is just, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well, you know, you're on periodically, maybe every 3 or 4 months, and in the late summer, early fall, you had said El Nino. Some models are saying it's going to be really strong this year, and by golly, I mean, it has been.
I mean, just look at the lack of snow. I mean, it's unbelievable. You mean, you know, you talk about the winter sports enthusiasts. I mean, you feel bad for them.
You do.
You really do. I mean, especially the folks that are owners and the people whose livelihoods rely on this. You
Absolutely.
Know, even bait shops that are relying on selling live bait for ice fishing and things like that. So, but you know, it's you live and die by weather when you're in that business. Whatever
it does happen from time to time, we forget about it. But there are those times, and I mentioned it at the beginning of the show. There are those times where it's been a very mild and pleasant winter until March, and then you get slammed. And that's what I'm waiting for the shoe to drop.
We'll see. You know what? I put some things on the air the other night. I try not to get too carried away because I love numbers.
Yeah.
Numbers will tell you whatever the heck you want them to say.
Right.
But the numbers obviously are completely undeniable. We have had 10.3 inches of snow this winter, which is just ridiculous.
Yep.
I mean, a couple days ago, you know, they keep records for the daily snowfall totals, records that is. So I don't know when it was. What's today? Thursday? I think it was Monday. The daily record snowfall, it was set in 2005, was 10.7 inches. So I'm like, you know, we've had 10.3 the entire winter.
Yep.
So it's the least amount of snow for what we call meteorological winter, which runs December, January, February, and also the warmest, because December was just ridiculous.
Yes, it was.
And we're going to be in the 60s middle of next week.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's I can't say you predicted it, but you did allude to the chance of this happening way back when.
Yeah, I mean, we knew that it was going to be an El Nino influenced winter. I don't know anybody that could have forecast that it would be to this degree. And it's been goofy even out on the West Coast. I mean, California did well in December and January. February was pretty lean for them. As far as snow and rain, because, you know, the hideous drought going on out there. But the pattern is starting to heat up again, so it's looking as though they're going to do quite well, at least for the first half of the month of March. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that we'll be pretty mild. What goes up must come down in the world of weather, and especially in the U.S.
So we, by the way, our guest is Jason Goff, and we were talking about long-term predictions. And I sent you this link. I know you saw it well before I sent you the link. This is a quote from USA Today, but it's been all over. Supercomputer quietly puts U.S. weather resources back on top. You remember a couple of years ago, the European model predicted that left hook that Hurricane Sandy was going to take.
Yep.
U.S. model said, no, I don't think so. Europeans were right. I think there was some egg on some faces. We spent a lot of money for this brand new Cray supercomputer, which processes 3 quadrillion calculations per second.
That's amazing. Now, a quadrillion, I actually had to look this up because I had forgotten.
You like numbers.
So you have million, billion, trillion, quadrillion.
Right. So that's a 1,000 billion?
1,000 trillion.
1,000 trillion. Boy.
Isn't that incredible?
That's a lot. But it's garbage in, garbage out. What info, what data is being processed.
Well, that's the key. And, you know, I mean, I talk to especially, you know, high school kids that can grasp it a little bit better than the elementary kids do when I go to visit. There was a guy back in the 1920s that did a 24-hour forecast by hand, okay? It only took him 3 years to do it, okay? And his forecast was spot on, but that doesn't do you any good. And so if you sort of take that line and draw it into the computer's thing, there are so many variables in the atmosphere.
Right.
The atmosphere is what we would deem an open system, as opposed to space, which is a closed system. Now, that's kind of counterintuitive, but that's how we can tell. I say we, not certainly not me, but that's how the astronomers and stuff know when the next solar eclipse is going to be and where it's going to be visible
from. Entirely predictable.
It is entirely predictable. I mean, there are some little waffles here and there in terms of the orbits and things, but you're talking about a very tiny bit. In the atmosphere, you know, there are so many different things that are going on, so you can't account for everything. A, cost is an issue, and B, it's computing speed. You can't, so you have to make these, what's the word I'm looking for? You have to make these approximations.
Right.
So if you have a weather station in Albany, for example, they launch the balloon from there, and then they launch one from Boston, and then you have other observations in between, but you don't have them 10 feet apart. They
right.
might be 25 miles apart or 50 miles apart.
Right.
So what's going on in between those 50 miles? And that's why nor'easters can be a real bear to forecast, because if they jog in between these so-called data points in these grids, that's how these models are set up on grids. And if they slide in between, they kind of go undetected.
It makes
sense.
But
yeah.
Now, so this supercomputer and the European computer and everything else, they're taking data from weather balloons, satellites, I assume aircraft, ground observations.
Yep, ships, all kinds of stuff. I mean, you're talking lots and lots of data that continue to come in.
But I assume that the tricky part here, and the part that where there's art over science, is deciding how much weight to give to each
yes.
input.
Yes, and I will never forget this. When I was a lowly neophytic
you were a larva back then.
Weather intern, and then I was a forecaster and a weather producer in Washington for the ABC affiliate down there. At the time, the so-called ADA, which is now called the NAM, which is pretty much out to lunch. People don't even really pay much attention to it anymore. It had spit out this huge coastal storm chugging up the Atlantic coast.
Yeah.
Now, people in D.C., and I don't mean to offend anybody that's from D.C., hopefully they're reasonable and they'll agree with me. People in D.C. can't drive in July, much less in the bad weather. They're the worst drivers I've ever come across.
Go down to Westchester. It's the same way. You get a little snow on 684, you're in trouble.
Oh, forget about it.
Yeah.
So, but the forecasts down there are difficult because that's, you know, those storms can start to form along the Carolina coast or maybe even at the mouth of the Chesapeake. So that's essentially on our doorstep
yeah.
down there.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have a little bit of time to watch it. But so there, the thing was is that there, the ADA every run for 4 or 5 runs in a row was consistently drawing this storm up. And it was a big one. And we're like, oh, my goodness, what is going on with this thing? And none of the other models had it. There weren't as many then as there are now.
Yeah.
And we come to find out that the input going into the ADA was wrong. It had estimated the sea surface temperatures to be 25 degrees C, which is 75 degrees in
Ooh.
Essence. And, yeah, that's gonna blow up a storm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
So, once they figure that out, then boom, the storm is gone. So we were looking at it. It just, the way that everything was set up, it didn't make sense. So we didn't go with it. Some other people did, and they were wrong.
Egg on their faces. All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Ann in Scotia. Ann, you're on. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. My local newspaper dutifully prints the weather information every day.
Okay.
And according to that, we've had 10.3 inches of snow.
That's correct.
Now, starting sometime back in December, and I don't know the exact date, they switched to just measuring snow. We've had a fair amount of rain.
Oh, we have.
Yes.
And especially last week, I think it was like Tuesday night overnight.
Yeah, it was brutal.
A fair amount.
Yep.
I would like to know how we are in the amount of liquid precipitation that we've had, and how that the rain and the snow that we've had compares to the average for other years.
Okay. I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. Basically, well, the short answer is I don't have a little laptop in front of me, so I can't.
Oh, I don't have my phone.
I can't remember off the top of my head how much rain we've gotten. But we actually, when we do get snow, there is what's called a liquid equivalent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you hear about the ratios. Generally,
what
the ratios
is that ratio? 10 inches to 1?
10 to 1 is a kind of the standard. Now, if you have a really cold day in January, it might be 15 to 1. If mm-hmm. you have a snow that falls this time of year, it might be more on the order of a 6 or a 7 to 1.
Ah.
And that's that heavier, wet, you know, good snowman making snow.
Yeah.
So as far as the snow goes, yeah, 10.3 is spot on, and it is way below average. Below average.
With the rain that we've had, which I would say is above average for winter. I just wonder how the two combined measure
yeah.
to what we should have or the average of what we have over a period of 10 years or whatever.
Oh, I'd have to look. You know what? I mean, that's a really easy question to answer, but I just don't have the numbers in front of me. I mean, we are basically because things were pretty dry in the month of January. We didn't have a whole lot of rain in January, really, or February.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've had a couple of episodes where we've had some pretty heavy rain. But as I said, too, though, and if you have snow, they do take into account the liquid equivalent of that because
mm-hmm.
obviously the snow melts. So that's what we're kind of looking at. There were some concerns late in the fall and into the wintertime that we were going to not, you know, drought is a term that gets thrown around too often.
Yeah.
California is in a drought. Droughts take a long time to set up. They take a long time to break down. We are, I don't want to say drought proof, but we are pretty drought resistant
yeah.
in this part of the country, but you have to look at things like wells and reservoirs and stuff like that. So, you know, I think we'll be all right. We're coming into the spring. We'll see what happens.
And thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest. Well, a caller on hold couldn't hold on, and we get this question every show, so we might as well dispense with
yeah.
it now. Anita wants you to explain what a heating degree day is. And why do we use them?
Okay, good.
Let's do this again.
You will do it again.
Okay.
No, it's good. If people keep asking, they
I
need
agree.
To know. Heating degree days are something that energy companies use to kind of get an idea of the amount of energy consumption. They also use it for futures. You know, people make money on the stock market in futures tradings and things like that for the price of oil, natural gas. Obviously, it's not been very good for them of late,
no.
especially with natural gas. But so here's the deal with heating degree days. It's a simple equation. It is what we call a base of 65. You average the high and the low for the day, and then you take that number and you apply it to the number 65. So let's say, for example, we have a high of 80 and a low of 40, just easy numbers to go by.
Yeah.
When that does happen once in a while, if the air is real dry, we would get a day like that maybe in early May. So the average of that is 60, right? 80
right.
plus 20, 80 yeah. plus 40 is 120 divided by 2 is 60.
Correct.
So 65 minus 60 is 5, so you have 5 heating degree days. If you have a day where the high is 20 and the low is 0, then you have 55 heating degree days.
Gotcha.
Now, they also have cooling degree days, too, because obviously it takes energy to cool, and that's a lot more prominent, obviously, down south and in those spots. So that's how that works.
Okay.
It just gives us an idea of energy consumption, and people do use it. A lot of folks use it. I get natural gas to heat the house, and I always kind of keep an eye on things from one year to the next, but other people will look at the heating degree days, and there is a norm just like there is for anything else, you know, in terms of temperatures and stuff like that. So
okay.
it's all a correlation to temperatures.
And really, you just do it to serve your corporate masters.
What's that?
All the petrol companies and the investors, right?
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
that
that's
what it's all about?
Well, it has to do also with the amount of investment and stuff and stock trading and all that. But yeah,
I
mean,
kidding and
just
giving you a hard time.
No.
Apologize for that.
No, no.
All right, we're going to take a break here. Jason Goff is our guest, and we'll be right back.
They may fix the weather in the world, just like Mr. Goff said. But tell me, the weather in my head. That's right.
Support comes from George Heigl, Cowan's representative, available for estate trust and full collection evaluations and consultations in the Capital Region. 518-369-7994. Ulster County Resource Recovery Agency, using food scraps and yard waste to create nutrient-rich compost to help conserve water and control weeds. Compost available for purchase, ucrra.org. And Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs. In downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. And before we get back to the phones, here's one that came in via email from Jennifer in the Southern Hudson Valley, who writes, "Thanks for your great daily weather forecasts. Always love them. Regarding the lack of snow this year, should we be worried about a drought?" And you talked about this. "Or has the rain made up for the lack of snow?" So we discussed this.
Yeah, we did. And I wish I had the numbers. I haven't been paying that much attention to them. I mean, we've had some pretty decent rains and stuff. But as I said, too, when you get into this part of the country, we are fairly drought resistant.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you never say never, but for us to really get into a spot where we were really, you know, on water restrictions and stuff would be quite a reach, because we've got, you know, our proximity to the coast, and just because of the general direction that our weather comes from and from the west and all that. You know, I think we'll be fine. You know, we'll see what happens. What I was going to tell you before, too, about the least amount of snow in the meteorological winter, I looked at the top 10 list from the National Weather Service office.
Yeah.
And those folks are great. I mean, they really are so accommodating with keeping track of all the records and numbers and stuff. So I looked it up. And if you look at all of those years that we had you know, not a whole lot of snow in those meteorological winters, the average snow from those years for the spring was 12.1 inches. So it's like they say, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future success. But if you believe the history, we're due for a foot of snow. Okay. I mean, so we'll see what happens.
That's what I was afraid of.
All right, we'll see.
Let's go back to the phones. Chris in Springfield, Mass. Chris, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I follow a meteorologist out of Boston. He has a Twitter handle. He has a blog. I don't want to say who it is in case, you know, what I'm saying is an unpopular opinion. But
No, that's all right. You can say who it is. Is it Eric Fisher?
No, it's David Epstein.
Okay.
So anyway, you know, I look at his blog, and like in the past couple of years when there's been a lot of snow or drought, he seems to deflect how much climate change has on those extremes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, among meteorologists, is there any disagreement or agreement about how much climate change affects our weather?
Yes, that's a good question. There is the American Meteorological Society actually put out a questionnaire a few years ago, and they wanted to get an idea of what broadcast meteorologists thought about climate change. The problem is, and people will ask me about this from time to time, you know, what do you think about global warming? Well, I will tell you that global warming is happening, and so will any other, you know, rational person.
Who looks at the data.
Right, who looks at the data. Now, to what level that is, you know, creating or causing climate change, that is still up for debate. But as I always tell people, you know, look, science is not a deli. You can't pick and choose things to fit your argument. So they will look at, they being the AMS, will kind of look and see what the general consensus is among meteorologists. And the majority of meteorologists, and it's not a vast majority, but more than 50%, kind of just poo-poo the whole thing and say, well, it's this or it's that. And then you, from there, it goes into this whole how this got into a philosophical question is just beyond me. But
the political question.
I mean, you've got people like this idiot Rick Santorum. I don't know if I can say that on
air,
but I just did. Well, I mean, come
Jason
on, man.
Goff,
you have a guy that's running for president of the United States who stands up and says global warming is a hoax. And I've said it on this air before. I'll say it. I'll debate that guy anywhere, anytime. So it just that drives me crazy, because people just get too caught up in what they hear on the radio or whatever, and they just kind of run with it.
Yeah.
Now, if you are looking at just sort of the varying opinions of people, it doesn't really matter to anything or anybody what's going on, because we have to keep an eye on what the science is doing, and our visions and stuff are being clouded. Now, there's a lot of bad information out there on both sides.
Absolutely true.
And absolutely, and now you have groups that are trying their best to sort of sift through all of the garbage on both sides to kind of put the truth out there. And there is a push to try to get television meteorologists to put out, you know, some information on global warming and climate change. The problem is that it's almost like talking about religion or abortion or something on the air. You just don't do it. And the other piece of that is, logistically, we just don't have the time.
Right. You're looking at things in the very near term, and that is a longitudinal look.
Right.
And so it's a tough nut. Chris, thanks for the call. We appreciate it very much. Let's go to Norbert in Montague, New Jersey. Norbert.
Yes, how you doing? I was just wondering, a couple of days ago, I was coming out of Port Jervis, New York with my granddaughter, and it was a real bright blue sky, but there was one of those, I guess they call them contrails from the jets.
Yes.
Where they leave that cloud behind, and this one was starting to spread out. But then as we were leaving the town, we spotted six more that were just starting in different angles, and it seemed as they spread out, it kind of dimmed the blueness of the sky. And then a couple of days later, I was coming back into Port Jervis from north of there, and my wife and I saw the same thing. I was wondering if that has any kind of an effect on anything.
Well, you know, what's interesting is the short answer is very little effect on anything. When you're down, certainly in that part of New Jersey and all that, you have Newark, you have JFK, you have LaGuardia, Teterboro, I mean, and then you have flights that are originating from Philly and Baltimore. So you have a lot of air traffic in a relatively short area. You tend to see contrails a lot more in the wintertime because it's colder aloft. So, and, you know, part of the exhaust from jets is water vapor. So you have that.
That's what you're seeing?
That's what you're seeing that's coming out of there. If the air is real dry, you don't see the contrails very much. And but they did a very interesting study. Right after 9/11, and I can't remember who the fellow's name was, but he had the foresight in such a hideous national tragedy to actually take samples of the atmosphere when the FAA grounded all flights. We closed off the airspace around the whole country, and the air quality went up, and it went up a lot in a hurry.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Now, that's the air quality. As far as what its effects on the weather are and things like that, again, you know, kind of up for debate, but it's certainly, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot. You're talking about a jet, you know, in the sky. I mean, look at the difference in the scope of the two of them.
So that would be, thank you, Norbert, for the call. So what Norbert is alluding to then is any effect of the reflectivity of the sun? In other words, of the reflectivity of the contrails of sunlight.
Yeah, but you know, they're not around that long to begin with, and it's just like anything else. They're just on a much smaller scale. It's kind of like having a thin overcast, but on a tiny, tiny scale. I mean, you're talking about a little sliver of exhaust that are coming out of these jets.
Jason Goff is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Bill in, is it Hyde Falls, New York? Bill, are you there?
Bill, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Bill.
Hi, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from High Falls, New York.
Okay, you are on the air.
Lightweight question. Jason, have you ever noticed, I've noticed this several times over the years, that we seem to get into these seven-day cycles where if it snows on Sunday evening, it'll snow every Sunday evening.
Yes.
For like, you know, 2.5 months. I know I've had an event I wanted to do on a Thursday in the summertime a few years ago, a bike ride, and I never got to do that because every Thursday that summer it rained.
Wow.
Yeah, it does happen. I mean, and people that are sort of relying on good weather obviously notice it a lot more than others, but just, you know, because it's my job, I tend to notice it too. Like, hey, it just rained last Tuesday or it snowed last Wednesday. But yeah, you're right. And I hear it a lot of times from people that have like golf leagues and, oh man, it stormed every Wednesday night and whatever. I used to play a lot of softball and it was sort of the same thing. So yeah, it can happen. I mean, it's a short cycle period, but it does happen.
All right, you're a numbers guy. That's anecdotal. Have you ever done any scientific look
no,
at the numbers?
No, I have not. So you're right. You're absolutely right, Ray. It is anecdotal. I don't have the data to pick it up, but just because I've been doing this now for a while, you do get into that. And it doesn't happen all the time, but you do tend to kind of get into these things where it's, you know, if the atmosphere is just kind of humming along and doing its thing, and then you can get right into some rain where it'll go every week.
Bill, great call. That's not a lightweight call. We appreciate
it. That's a good one.
Sure thing. Thanks.
Have a good one. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Vox Pop. Jason Goff is our guest. Let's go to Jill in Waterford. Jill.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not bad. I am one of those snow sports enthusiasts that you were talking about at the beginning of the show.
Mm.
I am up here crying because the skiing is just not...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still skiing a lot, but nothing like I normally would.
Yeah.
And you said 10.3 inches of snow?
That's it, yeah. And what's...
Are you averaging, you know, like within three states, including New Jersey, who got all that snow?
Well, that's Albany Airport, right?
Yeah, no, the 10.3 is an official measurement at the, and it's actually measured at the airport. So that is the official measurement for Albany. So, yeah,
it doesn't seem like we've had barely 4 inches of snow, let alone 10.
Right. Well, it's because it's come here and there, you know, and I think the most that we've had in a two-day period was like 3.2 or something like that.
And then it melted.
But that actually wasn't my real comment. I just wanted to throw that out there because
okay.
I found it hard to believe. Jason, I don't know if you remember or not, but I emailed you after the last time you were on asking you about
if there
would be an El Nino in the Southern Hemisphere during their winter.
You have a ski trip to New Zealand, I remember.
Yes, yes.
So?
And I just want to thank you very much for taking the time to answer my question for me, and I am praying to God that they've got a better winter than we do.
Well, I hope the same for you, Jill.
Thanks, Jill.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-348-2551 is our telephone number. News Channel 13 meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest today on Vox Pop. Let's go to Linda in Rensselaer. Linda.
Hello, Ray and Jason.
Hello.
Here's my question. Why is Saranac Lake often the coldest spot in the state and often in the country?
Love the question.
Yeah, no, that's good. And you will see that a lot in the spring and in the fall, where it's the coldest spot in the country. And certainly it's, you know, one of the coldest spots in the Northeast other than Mount Washington. You'll see that. The reason for that is because in these transitional seasons, it is real susceptible to these real cold nights. It tends to clear out up that way, and the wind goes calm, and that temperature drops like a stone. I mean, it is amazing to see the temperature difference, even from, like, Glens Falls, which that temperature there up at Floyd Bennett Airport tends to sit in a little bowl.
Yeah.
And that, you know, cold air is denser than warm air, so it's going to sit in there, and so you're going to have – it's almost at times not really even an accurate representation, because we have media partners at the Post-Star newspaper,
yeah,
and they have a thermometer there, and oftentimes the temperature could be 10 or 15 degrees higher in downtown Glens Falls than it is at the airport.
That's amazing.
But, yeah, but in Saranac Lake, in these – you know, in the spring and in the fall, you will – a lot of times you will see that. Another area is Truckee, California, which is kind of in the southern California, but up in the mountains. And so you'll
that's
see
that's very
that.
Cold as well.
It can get real
Southern California?
Cold. Southern California, man. Yeah.
Wow.
You can be in LA in June and see snow on the mountains there.
Well, there you go.
But it's a transitional season thing, and you know, and also because of the way that our prevailing wind direction is out of the northwest. So we tend to also get these dips in the jet stream, so that we could get a nice little dip in the jet stream as things kind of get kinked around in these transitional seasons. And it just so happens that Saranac Lake can be right at the heart of it. So it's going to bear the brunt of that colder air because it's up in that elevation.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All righty. You're welcome.
Thanks, Linda. And you know, maybe 2 weeks ago now, we had the terrible cold snap that weekend. It was
yes.
very cold.
Yep.
So what exactly happened? This was a jet stream situation where
yeah.
It was trapping the cold air? Am
well,
I wrong?
Well, we just would actually, you know, and thank God we haven't heard a whole lot about
polar
it this
vortex?
Year. The polar vortex.
Yes.
For crying out loud.
Ding,
yeah,
ding,
it,
ding.
That thing was, it's been real tight all winter long,
right.
And that's why the colder air has been pretty much confined
and
well
to our
north.
Is El Nino keeping it up there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So what will happen is what happened that particular weekend was that it started to weaken a little bit and it got a little kink here and a little push there. I mean, everything is related around the globe when you're talking about a global pattern like an El Nino. And so it weakened and it just allowed that colder air to kind of bleed its way down toward us. We got a little cold snap. I mean, you know, yeah, it was cold, but it certainly, you know, it wasn't any kind of, you know, unprecedented cold. It was just unprecedented for this winter.
Yeah,
that's all.
You make a point. This one comes in via email from John, who says, some people love to pick on the meteorologist for being wrong. I am not one of them. I've always found a 24-hour weather report to be very accurate, and of course, accuracy decreases as the forecast time is extended.
Yes.
Do you have any statistics as to the accuracy of a 2-, 3-, or 4-day forecast? Love this question.
I do, too. John, I'm going to write you in for president of the United States, too. We appreciate that.
Okay.
We are, you know, people, and it's funny because when weather and psychology kind of get together, you know, people remember things differently and they say, oh, you know, and I've heard it 100 times, you know, I want to have your job. I can be wrong all this time and still get paid and all that. And I'm just like, yeah, that's the first time I heard that joke in the last
right.
5 minutes.
Yeah,
yeah, that's great.
Well.
But, you know, it's all in good fun. It doesn't, you know, you have to have thick skin to be in this business, too, for sure.
Absolutely.
But the truth is that we are right a lot more than we get credit for, and that's fine too. And day one is about 92%, and then it sort of drops off from there as we get into, I don't have the numbers in front of me, I can't remember, but it drops off a little bit into day two, and then you see a little bit more of a steeper drop off as you get beyond about day three.
So a 7-day forecast is essentially a crapshoot.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, it depends on the time of year. Summertime, 7-day forecasts tend to be the most accurate because in the summer, everything slows down. You know, you can get an idea. And even in other seasons, you can get an idea of whether at least we're going to get warmer or colder.
Yeah.
This part of the country is a little bit tricky in the winter because of nor'easters, which can kind of throw a monkey wrench into the whole thing. But once you get into day 7, yeah, it tends to get a little bit trickier because of the models.
So I imagine your producers or the news directors are saying, look, Jason, you got to give me 6, 7, 8 days. And I'm sure meteorologists say, can I give you 2?
It's no, it's part of the drill. And, you know, I don't mind a 7-day forecast at all. And here's why. Because our viewers are our customers. And in whatever your business is, you serve your customers.
Yeah, but if the accuracy isn't there at 7 days, then how are you serving anybody?
This is the psychology of it. That's a good question, and this is fascinating. We do a lot of research, as a lot of other businesses do, to kind of see what we can do to keep people happy. What, you know, we want them to be able to look to us for whatever they want. And people have said, resoundingly they've said, we want a 7-day forecast. We will forego the accuracy of days 6 and 7, but we want to see the weekend forecast.
So you can just keep it very vague then for
the
6 and 7.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll put as much into a day 7 forecast as I do a day 1 in terms of, you know, I'm not just going to throw a random number out there, but I also know that there's a good possibility that at least the high forecast is going to change. I mean, it's very, I keep track of all of my forecasts every day.
Yeah.
And when I'm filling in that day 7, you know, from 7 days prior, it's very rare that the numbers are spot on. I mean, they're going to be off a little bit.
Now, will this new supercomputer, the U.S. is now using the Cray supercomputer, help that in the long run? Will it increase the days of accuracy?
That remains to be seen. I mean, short-term and long-term forecasting are different to begin with. These supercomputers are going to help us when we need it most, day of, next day, even a couple of days out. I mean, you've seen some of the forecasts that have come out from the Storm Prediction Center, for example, in Oklahoma, where they might say, hey, even 4 or 5 days out. And you'll see that now coming into the spring, especially, you know, hey, if you're in the state of Arkansas or if you're in, you know, western Tennessee or whatever, you know, on Tuesday, duck, it's going to be a bad day. And we'll at least have an idea that that's a possibility because the more warning and the awareness that people have. I mean, down south last week, I was texting. I have good friends. Obviously, I went to school down there, and I have a lot of friends still that live down there. And they closed the schools in Louisiana and Mississippi, and for good reason, and they had a ton of tornadoes.
They nailed
there.
It, yeah. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, educating children pre-K through grade 12 and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. Careers in Transition LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn sessions, resume and cover letter writing. CareersInTransitionLLC.com. And Autobahn Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of Asian-made and imports, specializing in late-model Volkswagen, Subaru, Audi, and BMW. AutobahnTechnic.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. Ray Graff here. And before we get back to the phones, Jason, here's one that came in from Paul, and who says, hey, Jason, big thanks in the beginning of the show for mentioning the struggles of bait shop owners who are hurting from the weak winter bait sales to ice fishermen. As New England's largest guided ice fishing company, the number one question I get asked is how strong the ice is. I find myself constantly explaining the difference between black and white ice. Mm-hmm. Could you please briefly elaborate on this?
Between black and white ice?
Yeah.
I've not been ice fishing in a long time,
okay.
But you definitely want to be able to get out there onto some of that white ice because it's thicker. But you also have other pieces. I'd never go ice fishing on a river. Because you have too many currents that you can't really account for. And so when you have that blacker ice, you can have weak spots in it.
Yep.
And, you know, so you're able to kind of see through a little bit more. The white ice, you know, is good and thick. And if you have a hand auger, you're going to be tired by the end of the day trying to, you know, drilling holes. You're allowed 5 tip-ups per person and all of that. So, but, you know, I mean, we have our National Grid First Warning Cams. We have one up on the southern end of Lake George, and I've seen people out there. I mean, the water on the south end of the lake tends to be a little shallower.
Yeah.
But it's not like it's, you know, 2 feet deep. But there are people that are out there ice fishing.
Let's go back to the phones and Laura in Middletown. Oh, Laura, you got to turn your radio down a little bit, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Sorry.
That's okay. You're on.
Okay. I heard before the caller about the contrails.
Yes.
And I had heard from a scientist about those trails, and he said that actually contrails usually dissipate quite quickly because it's moisture, like it as you walk down the road and you breathe in the cold air, how you don't turn around and look and see a long trail
right
behind you from, you know, as you walk along.
Right.
And they actually said the planes are putting out ionized aluminum and barium.
Well,
and that the soils have been tested, and they found an alarming rate of high aluminum content in the soil, and they said it's killing the fish.
Well, I would blame things going on the ground before I would blame the airplanes for that. And the other piece of that is right.
Well, you can look it up about, they're called chemtrails.
No, I understand, but I don't subscribe to that. But
I mean, I can taste it in my mouth, the metal.
Okay.
I can taste that aluminum.
All right.
You
well,
know, and I think it's a shame.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for the call. Let's go over to Georgia in Lenox, Massachusetts. Georgia, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
That woman just brought up quite the issue I was going to be talking about.
Oh.
Yes, there's a lot of interest in the chemtrails, and I was curious to see what he would have to say, what Jason would have to say about them, because they do dissipate. The chemtrails do not dissipate. A regular passenger airplane, the chemtrail is very short, and disappears quickly. Okay. So I've heard the same things that this woman brought up about the aluminum and the barium.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, every time you ask about it, you get shuffled away.
Okay.
It's like, oh, right, right, it's a conspiracy. But, you know, it doesn't go away. And people, it's a huge issue in the West where there's a lot more sky to look at.
Right.
And it's going on here. And if listeners want to pay attention to the sky, you'll see two or three, couple days before rain is forecast, they'll be up there. And they don't, you know, regular airlines fly in pathways in the sky. They don't, you know, scramble up there and fly all around
okay.
like these guys do. And I just think it's something people ought to ask more about, because it does affect if those things are being, shot out into the atmosphere, then it is falling on all of us. And why can't we get the information about it?
Oh, so
thank you for bringing up the subject. I really appreciate it.
Okay,
hey,
you're welcome.
Call.
Have a good
appreciate
afternoon.
Appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Jason Goff is our guest. Let's go to Rich in Wilton. You're on.
Yeah, good afternoon. Jason, this is regarding weather radar. Now, just about all TV stations show predictions of areas of rain or thunderstorms dancing around the next morning or afternoon. And I wonder, what is the basis for this? In my experience, you just can't predict exactly where rains or thunderstorms are going to be. So what computer algorithms are used for this? Where does this come from? Or is this sort of like fluff or something like that that's just being used?
No, it's not fluff. That I will tell you. And you're right. I mean, it's difficult to say, hey, there's going to be a thunderstorm over Wilton, you know, in 3 days at 2:17. We're never going to be able to tell you that.
Okay.
So I'll answer your question in two ways. One is if we have a cold front, for example, that's coming through, that is, I say in air quotes, easier to sort of time out to say, all right, well, we're going to have a line of thunderstorms along this front or a squall line out ahead of it, or we might even have the potential for some supercells that'll come out way ahead of it if we're really in an unstable air mass. So it is the general idea of having isolated storms or widely scattered storms or even scattered storms around out ahead of a cold front. And we would, you know, we will never say, okay, I mean, it's difficult to even say the northern half of our area or the southern half of our area. Sometimes we can do that, but more often than not, we cannot. So just in terms of putting up storms, and I'll say this on the air, you know, several times, and it's not to try to, you know, cover my hide or anything. It's just trying to get the information out to everybody, basically saying, look, if you're going to be outside today, I don't care where you are, keep your eyes to the sky. If you see dark clouds approaching and you're on a boat, get off the water,
yeah.
that sort of thing. So and these models can pick up on instability in the atmosphere, you know, CAPE, which is convective available potential energy, and things like that in the summer that you look at to say, okay, the CAPE, the environment is going to be real juicy and it's going to be ripe for the picking in terms of storms showing up, or we'll see them coming along a line, say like along a cold front, which you would, you know, we'll start to see maybe in about, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks from now. Does that answer your question?
Sure. In my experience, yeah, close to the time of the actual event, of course, you can extrapolate. Just simply look at the radar and say, well, it's predicted to move this way.
Right.
So certainly it's going to be X number of miles downrange. You know, within a certain time period.
Of course.
That's like extrapolation. I used to do this as a pilot weather briefer. I used to explain it to everybody and the pilots and tell them, you know, how to just stay away from these storms and all that. But
yes.
To see the stuff like dancing around is the only way I can put it, like Jell-O. They showed a thing in a time lapse, like speed it up, you know.
Yeah.
But to say that, I just think it's kind of misleading the way it's done.
Well,
an area of storms is understandable, but
it's more of a generalization. But the other thing too is that one of the in-house models that we run is a 4-kilometer model, which means the grids are 4 kilometers
yeah.
wide, which is pretty
mm-hmm.
small, and so those. Models, now it actually goes out beyond 24 hours, but generally that's a real short-term forecasting model because it's, again, it goes back to putting in more variables, but it's forecasting out less time. So you're only going out 24 hours. So you have a better idea of where things are going to go. And you can look, the Storm Prediction Center out of Norman, Oklahoma has a great website, and they have a lot of forecasting tools on there. And they can actually give you some ideas with contours as far as where the real pockets of instability are.
Yeah.
And so those models can extrapolate that data or those data and be able to at least give an idea. So maybe we could say, all right, well, there's going to be a storm in northern Saratoga County. We don't know if it's going to be over Wilton or Ballston Spa, but we know that it's going to be in that vicinity between, say, 3 and 4 o'clock. That's about as good as it gets.
So in the warmer weather, there's more energy in the atmosphere,
yes,
right? And so it's tougher? There are more variables at play?
Well, no, it not so much that is that you know, meteorology 101 says that the warmer air is, the more water vapor it can hold. And water vapor is the fuel for these storms. That's why we don't get thunderstorms in the winter generally. I mean, we had one last week. We had thunder and lightning,
yes, we
which
did.
Was really something
very loud.
Else. But that's just the evidence of how strong the dynamics were, because that was coming through in the middle of the night. That was really something else. So it's just in the, and that's why we typically will get storms in the afternoon in the summer, is because the ground has had time to heat up, that hot air rises and it interacts with all the moisture around. And then if you have any other triggers that are around, boom.
Well, I guess my question, and I guess I inartfully posed it, are forecasts more accurate in colder temperatures? In other words, there is less motion of molecules and less variability?
No, that's a good question, but I would say no. Okay. There's not any one, you know, I would say that our toughest time of year to forecast is actually in the winter, but that's largely as a function of coastal storms.
Okay.
And trying to figure out the tracks of these things and precipitation type and all that. In the summer, everything tends to slow. The jet stream slows down, patterns slow down, so you can actually get a more accurate sort of mid-range forecast, if you will.
All right, let's go to Lee in Ghent. Lee, you're on with Jason Goff.
Hi, Jason. This is so fascinating, and I'm kind of building on that idea of storms. When I was in bed last week hearing the thunderstorm, it really frightened me because it was so unusual.
Yep.
And it made me wonder about how trends might point toward possible tornadoes in this area, which are really rare, but could that, given global warming and those kinds of trends, could that be more frequent?
You mean having more tornadoes around? You know, in theory, I suppose. I would not be too quick to say that tornadoes are rare here. Certainly, they are more rare here than they are in a lot of other parts of the country. But I'm always one to let folks know that, you know, we always have to be on our guard for the potential for severe weather. We would know, hopefully, a day or two in advance that there may be an opportunity for some really rough and tumble weather, and we would let you know about that, of course. So, in theory, you know, the theory behind, you know, stronger storms and stuff as it relates to global warming is that if you have, you know, warmer temperatures, then the atmosphere can store more water vapor, which is more fuel for the storms.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the simplistic view of that. So, you know, time will tell, in other words. But we'll, you know, as far as how things will work out this spring, we'll see.
Lee, thank you very much. All right, here's one that came in via email. And I got to say, always on my mind every time I hear or have to read a forecast that says north of I-90 or south of I-90.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Jody. Says, why is the I-90 corridor a brake line for forecasting? South versus north, maybe different. I live right on that line and pay attention to both, and that's from Jody. That's a good question.
It is a very good question, yeah. So, well, Jody, you can, you know, jump across the thruway and, you know, experience different weather, you know. No, it
just an arbitrary thing?
Well, in a sense, yes, it tends to, first of all, you know, the thruway westbound runs through the Mohawk Valley.
Yeah.
And valleys and higher elevations have different effects on weather. You can get stronger winds that'll run down the valley and all of that. But it in essence, it is sort of an arbitrary line that as you get on the north side of I-90, the elevation starts to go up. I mean, you're starting to get into the foothills of the Adirondacks, and you're getting out of the valley to begin with, so you have that much of an issue. Now, of course, south of the thruway, westbound, then, yeah, you're running into the hills of Schoharie County and into the Catskills as well.
Oh, makes sense.
But it's farther south, and so there can be that line. When I was forecasting in D.C., and this was more fascinating in a sense because elevation wasn't an issue, I-95 corridor was really sort of that dividing line between snow. I mean, obviously, as you head west from there, you head up into the Blue Ridge and all that, and then you get closer to the Chesapeake and the Eastern Shore, Maryland and whatever. But it was the elevation had less of a role there, but it just kind of the way that things set up. So locally here, as it relates to, you know, to I-90 westbound, it is more a function of it's just sort of the latitude that it is. And north of that, you're getting up into elevation, which completely changes the game.
All right. And this one came in from Stuart. And it dovetails with what we were just talking about, who says, with the snowstorm in February, there was a distinct snow line that paralleled the I-84 line. Mm-hmm. South of I-84, lots of snow. At north, no snow at all. And Stu wonders what caused that.
Just the luck of the draw, man. That's all there is to it. That, you know, there has to be, and once in a while you'll see it. You know, you might be able to see standing at your house and you look across the way or across the field or whatever and it's pouring rain. There's got to be a start and a stop line somewhere.
Well, you're right. And it's so funny, especially when it's raining hard. I remember I was living over in Albany, and literally two houses up, pouring rain. You could walk through the line and not raining at my house.
Isn't
it was
that
the
something?
Craziest thing.
Yeah.
So it has to happen somewhere.
It has to happen. Just like George Carlin says, you know, somewhere in the world by process of elimination is the world's worst doctor. The worst thing is somebody has an appointment with him next Thursday.
Okay, and this one is from Susan, who says, just wanted to recommend a good book that helped me to understand the formation of our modern-day weather reporting and the wonderful service they provide. Isaac Storm recounts the 1900 hurricane in Galveston, Texas.
Great book.
It was excellent, and I recommend it to those who are interested in the history of weather forecasting. So you've read that one?
Yes, that's a fantastic book, a fascinating book, really well written. And by the way, if somebody wanted to get another a weather book, just a general weather book, I will tell you, there's a book out there by a fellow named Jack Williams. He's a writer for USA Today. It's been out for 25 years. You can get it on Amazon for like $15, and it's really well done. It's updated every year, so now there are sections in there about climate change and all of that, but it has a lot of really good illustrations, and it's not too sophomoric, but it's not too far over your skis either.
Right.
It's a really well-written book. So again, and it's called The Weather Book by Jack Williams, USA Today. If you just look that up on Amazon, you're good to go.
Easy to remember. Kovacic ever write a book?
You know what? He had a book that was, and I can't remember how it worked out, but when he worked at Channel 10, I used to watch him when I was a kid.
Yeah,
and
me too.
I love to remind him of that.
Yeah.
Because
he's old.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're getting old too, but he's really old.
So, no, I have a book of his, but I don't think he wrote it. I think he consulted on it.
Ah, okay.
And so I asked him about it, and he, he could have told me that he wrote it, and I would have believed him.
All right,
but
fair enough.
No, I think he consulted on it, and they kind of used him to market it in that sense as well. But it's a good book. I still have it.
All right, Jason Goff, you have to write a book before the next time you're on the program. News Channel 13 meteorologist Jason Goff, thank you for being here. Support comes from Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, including Bevel LaFont and Pro Design, progressive lenses from Varilux and Nikon at Maui Jim, Costa and Ray-Ban sunglasses, SHEEHYOpticians.com. Pine Cobble School, Williamstown, Massachusetts, where last year students consumed 7,000 pounds of vegetables through the Wild Oats Healthy Lunch Program. A good beginning never ends. PineCobble.org. Colby Attorney Service, Corporate Formations, Document Retrieval Services, Court Filings, and Legal Publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939, ColbyService.com, and Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, QFCC.com. Thanks again to Jason Goff for being here. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Deb Malik answered the phones. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. See you tomorrow.